Stalin's dead.
He's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Stalin will be loving this.
Ну, это мерзость потрясающая.
Фильм не надо показывать.
Надо заставить всех посмотреть эту гадость.
It's been banned in Russia. It's been called an insulting mockery of the Soviet past. Police even raided a Moscow cinema that dared to screen it. It, of course, is Scottish director Armando Iannucci's black comedy, The Death of Stalin, which lampoons the power struggles, intrigue, and backstabbing that followed the Soviet dictator's demise in 1953. What does Russia's official reaction to this highly acclaimed film tell us? Is it simply about Russian sensitivity about the darkest chapters of their history? Is it the result of the revival of the cult of Stalin in the popular imagination and the Kremlin's manipulation of this for political purposes? Or is it something more? Has the death of Stalin touched a nerve not just because it's seen as a mockery of the Soviet past, but also because it appears to be a potential harbinger of the Russian future? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome, Mark.
Hi again.
So, and also with us in the studio is Anna Aratunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group, and author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome back, Anna.
Great to be here again. Thanks.
Hey, great to have you. Mark, let's start with you, since unlike Anna and I, you've actually seen this film. I've watched the trailer again and again and again and have been wishing that it would like show up in cinemas here. It hasn't yet. I'll be sure to see it once it does. I've read numerous reviews, followed the controversy, but you saw the film. What do you make of the film, and what do you make of Russia's reaction to it?
Well, I'm start first of all with the film. I must say I loved it. Now, in part, I suppose that's because I am a sort of Russia-Soviet history wonk with a very black sense of humour. But I thought particularly, and this is something I wrote about on my blog, was in some ways I felt that although there were certain sort of po-faced responses from some quarters saying, well, it's not exactly accurate, and it's not. It basically sort of...
of course not.
Not only with the humour, but also in terms of the chronology, it basically squeezes everything into a very short period and so forth. But in some ways, I think precisely by not pretending to be some kind of biopic documentary, in many ways, I felt it was that much more authentic in terms of raising certain elements about precisely how this collection of ghastly human beings respond to, react to, and also try to take advantage of the death of an even more ghastly human being. And in that respect, I mean, actually, I would just want to raise one point. I mean, Simon Russell Beale's Beria is an absolute tour de force. He really does make a magnetic representation of this person. But the one thing that particularly struck me was, I mean, obviously, Beria, even by the standards of Soviet secret police chiefs, so we're talking about a very high bar, was an unusually disgusting individual. But nonetheless, I mean, I think in the film, what's fascinating is this one point in which everyone's sort of scheming, and particularly trying to use Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, sort of for their own political purposes. And at one point she says to him, you know, how do I know I can trust you? And he says, you can't. Don't trust anyone. But remember, I'm the one that actually told you that. And what was fascinating was precisely that he was in some ways, I hesitate to talk about hipster Beria, but I mean, he certainly was kind of that ironic and knowing way in which he was both using all the platitudes of the system and yet was aware of its meaningless. And I think this actually leads into quite why I suspect it turned out to be such a neuralgic issue. And one is, of course, about the representation of Stalin and the Stalinists and the present insecurities and vulnerabilities that sort of targets about history. And I mean, Anna and I were talking about this yesterday, so I'll let Anna talk about why she feels that the regime felt it had to ban it for the Stalinist angle. But there's two other points that I would want to make. First of all, this is about succession. It is about how you succeed and follow a leader who basically has, like a black hole, swallowed up everything else around him. And the question becomes, do you want another Stalin or do you want something different? Well, for obvious reasons, that has a certain political resonance at the moment. But the second thing, this is about, to use the word of the moment, collusion, collaboration. The interesting thing is that with the exception of Molotov, who is constantly trying to sort of reinterpret and explain things in ideological terms in the film, essentially this is a bunch of cynical opportunists who are, of course, when Stalin is around, toadying up to Stalin and staying up late watching Westerns with him, because he wants to stay up late watching Westerns and they don't like it. Doing whatever it takes. And likewise, as soon as Stalin is dead, they're looking for new orthodoxies to mobilise. You know, as you get both, you know, Khrushchev becoming irate because Beria is now playing the liberal card and saying we should open up the gulags and so forth. Well, likewise, essentially what this is saying is that your elite may be telling you, the supreme leader, exactly what you want to hear. They want to say that they are marching in lockstep with you. But the moment they no longer have to fear you, all that will disappear in the name of self-interest. Again, there is a distinct resonance at the moment.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that, Mark. I mean, I of course commented on this in the Daily Vertical this week and made the point that, necessary caveat, Putin's not Stalin, but the system's never been this centralized since Stalin, never been so dependent on one man. As the historian Sergei Medvedev wrote in Republik.ru, like 65 years ago, the only political institution is the body of the leader. And I think that's, for all those reasons you spelled out, I think the reaction has much more to do with the present than it has to do with any kind of glorification of the Soviet past. And I know you've been thinking about this a lot, and I know you've been thinking about it in conjunction with the controversy that erupted last year over the film Matilda, which had the audacity to depict Tsar Nicholas II as having an affair, being human. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's interesting to juxtapose what happened with Matilda and what happened with this film. First of all, the authorities, in the case of Matilda, as we know, they not only let the screening happen, they had to actually set up protection and security measures to basically protect it from the backlash against the film. With Death of Stalin, initially they wanted to screen it, and then they saw it, they were horrified and said no. This is, I'm assuming that that's what happened, because I don't really think the Kremlin has a policy to ban this kind of stuff. I think the Kremlin strategy, the Kremlin policy, from what I've heard, is that let's just let this happen. Let's not ban anything, because by banning it, we're drawing even more attention to it. So to ban the film, to not let it, to revoke the license, there had to be some sort of massive emotional insecurity about what this could entail, the kind of backlash that it could produce.
You don't think Medinsky has the juice by himself to do this? You think this would have had to been decided at a higher level?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know whether it was him or whether it was decided on a higher level, but I think that the thinking behind this reflects a certain fear by the administration of the forces that the Kremlin itself has kind of unwittingly unleashed by, mobilizing patriotism, by mobilizing nationalism, by abetting the rehabilitation of Stalin. These forces have come to the fore. Now, that's one issue. Another issue that I think we, in the case of Death of Stalin and to a lesser extent with Matilda, is the sensitivity towards holy cows in Russia. When I was looking at the groups that were that wanted to ban Matilda, and I had a lot of conversations with these Orthodox groups, and I was just trying to understand the thinking behind this, right? And I mean, what for these people, power is sacred. And all power is sacred, whether that is Nicholas, Putin, or Stalin. The reason I think that power is sacred, and I'm going to get into like really dark territory here, is because this kind of power, which is not institutional, which is
it's personalized.
It's the only kind of power that Russia has really ever known in terms of any successful periods. Like, Yeltsin was derided.
I just want to jump in there just really quickly, Anna, because I read a piece this morning by Fyodor Krasheninnikov in Novoe Vremya, and he made the argument that the real reason this was banned is because the Russian state is seen as holy and infallible in all forms at all times. This is his quote.
Right. Well, there is this thinking. I don't want to say that that's how everybody thinks. I want to identify this as a kind of superstition that tends to arise when the Kremlin, for other purposes, seeks to mobilize patriotic sentiment. Mm-hmm. And which is, at Crisis Group, we've been doing a lot of work on how exactly the Kremlin has been mobilizing this and what the effects are. And some of the effects is things that they can't really control, as with the Matilda film. Now, psychologically, what that superstition about joking about the sacredness of power is, it's actually about a fear of death. We're...
You're getting Freudian on it.
I know. It's just... I'm sorry. I've spoken to a lot of people about the cult of Stalin, and it just strikes me again and again how difficult it is for people to reconcile themselves to this having happened in the past. Sociologists today will speak of a certain cognitive dissonance, that it takes a lot of effort for people and for society to recognize that, you know, Stalin did this. I mean, we're asking... It's almost just, I mean, I'm not really surprised that the film is drawing this kind of reaction. I mean, it's a huge step for a person to recognize that Stalin killed his grandparents. He hasn't even, a lot of Russians haven't even reconciled themselves to that. And now we're asking them to be able to, you know, jokingly deal with this this concept. I think a lot of this is understandable. The question is, what do you do about it? Do you ban the film? Well, probably not. But I think it should be understood that you can't really, this is not something that you can lecture Russia on from the outside. Even by banning the film, I think the authorities, and I'm going to be an optimist here, are raising, maybe unintentionally, they're actually drawing more attention to this issue.
Yeah.
And this is just something that society is going to need to process, to confront.
I mean, and in fairness, and it's, of course, different, but this isn't exactly unique to Russia. I remember being in Austria. God, it must have been around 2004, 2005, if I'm not mistaken. And it was when the film The Sound of Music was being shown. Not the film, the stage play of The Sound of Music was being shown for the first time in Austria. And a friend of mine from the BBC was covering it as a big news event. And I was like thinking, why? Well, obviously, there is a reason why. That, remember that scene with the big swastika in the background? Well, you can't show that in Austria for obvious historical reasons that require no elaboration. But I'm not sure how a film lampooning Hitler would go over in Germany or Austria. Mark, what are your... anything to add here to what I'm...
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's exactly the case that we need to be aware of. This is something that the authorities did, but wouldn't necessarily have initiated. And we've seen this before. I mean, actually, that the authorities, and the authorities are obviously by no means united, actually often get pushed by the very forces that they mobilise. We could look at, for example, the prosecution of Pussy Riot, where clearly the first instinct was actually just not to throw the book at them, but then the Russian Orthodox Church leaned in, and there was that sense of, well, you know, how many times have we used the Orthodox Church? They've accumulated some markers, they're trading some in. And yes, in the process, Pussy Riot became this sort of iconic figure. With Matilda, it's actually figures such as the former Crimean prosecutor, now Duma deputy, Poklonskaya, who, you know, her peers, on the whole, regard her as barking mad in many ways because she believes this stuff. She hasn't properly worked out that
she's
the
not
job,
cynical enough.
Exactly. The job of being a Duma member is to be an acquisitive kleptocrat pragmatist, not to actually believe all this stuff. And so there is this kind of almost embarrassment when someone who comes along and pushes. But again, how do you speak against that? And likewise, with Death of Stalin, exactly, there is that sense of, this is real for Russians. This is not just simply something that a small proportion of the elite are worried about, though they clearly have their own particular sensitivities. It is the fact that genuinely anything that pokes fun at Stalin You know, in some ways, you have to find peace with Stalin before you can properly poke fun at him. Otherwise, we're in. I mean, you're talking about. I was just thinking of the Mel Brooks film, The Producers.
The Producers. No, I was actually that
Hitler,
was coming
the,
to that was the
musical.
The Springtime for Hitler.
You know,
right.
I think we're a way away from a Springtime for Stalin moment. In Russia,
I would be interested to look back and see how The Producers was received mm-hmm. in Germany and Austria.
Quite
well, that would be.
I have
interesting
no idea.
To see.
But again, I mean, final point I'd make is, again, going back to this business of power being kind of a power cult, indeed, one could say. You know, if one thinks about the sort of the leaders, exactly, they have all had something to legitimate them. I mean, for Nicholas and his predecessors, it was divine right. They were Tsar because God said so. For Stalin, well, essentially it was Marxism-Leninism,
right.
Stalinism
right.
was mobilized to provide that. And for Putin, ironically, it's not, I would suggest, about, you know, making Russia great again or whatever. It's that 80% approval rating. It mm-hmm. is precisely that actually he therefore stands, therefore, as the representation of the Russians.
Dipped, according to the latest film poll.
Well, there you go. But anyway, but it's still, I think he... can feel fairly reasonable about it. But there is this point that precisely in all of these cases, what they are legitimated by is not process. It's not just winning a vote or something like that, or because the law says so. It's this invoking something higher, something that is kind of trans-legal, trans-constitutional. Mm. And what can be more corrosive to that than humour?
But at the same time, I mean, we all heard all the Soviet jokes in the Soviet era, right? So on one hand, power is sacred. But on the other hand, the jokes about the leader are widespread. But yet, this film touches a nerve. Explain that.
Well, I think that there's a certain acceptable hypocrisy. You can talk about these things in your kitchen mm-hmm. or among friends, but it shouldn't be like made public and made, you know, into this national, you know, spectacle. That's the thing. You can't publicly ridicule. You can do it privately, maybe, but you've got to have a certain, you know, the appearances that you're afraid. That ritual that this is something sacred that you do in hush-hush voices, that adds to the sacralization, essentially. When that's exploded, as Marx says, through humor, that's basically saying, okay, there's nothing special here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's take apart what was actually happening following the death of Stalin, and let's look at what this actually was. And when you look at it as it actually was, there's nothing sacred going on.
Right. No, it's
and then people
banal power struggle among
right.
very cynical men.
And then what comes to the fore is essentially for a lot of these people is the unbearable idea. Then what that means is all this suffering was for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And at least now there's this myth that the suffering was justified because we beat the Nazis. But when you expose that, you know, yeah, we beat the Nazis, we beat one force of evil with another force
right.
of evil. How do you reconcile yourself to that? How do you then deal with, okay, what was that suffering there for then?
Now, I want to go back to this contrast with Matilda,
mm-hmm.
because that was touching a sacred cow too, right?
Exactly.
Nicholas II having an affair is, I guess, touching a very sacred cow and touching a nerve. Why were the authorities more lenient there on that one, do you think?
Well, I think they would have been lenient on Stalin as well. But now Stalin is coming up with the experience of what happened with Matilda. And I suspect that they might have just been afraid of a similar backlash.
I think there's also a difference in that Stalin was a winner. Nicholas, let's be honest, was a loser.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, no one is building Russian national myth on the fact that Nicholas.
Although he's been canonized,
he's been canonized. I mean, this is, but even then, but that's in this very orthodox sense of basically someone who suffered,
right?
Someone who showed dignity despite the fact that everything went against them. Stalin, the mobilization of Stalin is very different. I mean, A, obviously it's in living memory, but B, Stalin is the great patriotic war. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is it. It's not actually about the gulags. It's not about the Bielomore Canal or anything like that. You know, it's about the Great Patriotic War. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, you can't really unpick the two.
Mark, I know you wanted to talk a bit about the kind of the messaging that's been coming mm-hmm. out in films. I'm curious what you have to say about
just before I finish, just a quick point actually about the humour angle. I mean, A, it's worth mentioning that exactly even in pre-revolutionary times, there were the anecdote, I mean, and proverbs. My favourite was always, you know, even a bishop will steal if he's hungry. You know, that's still playing. But also, let's remember that, firstly, one of the sort of the big deals in early Putinism was taking Kukli, the puppet show,
right.
Sort of satire program off air, which was allowed under Yeltsin, mm-hmm. but there was no room on it. And one of Navalny's strengths is not just when he's on videos that he shows the corruption,
he's funny.
But he does so exactly
he's
wittily.
Funny.
But anyway, yes, talking about another thing, I was thinking about sort of looking at the 2017 sort of big blockbuster Russian films. And trying to think, okay, can we learn anything from what's been coming out of those? And I mean, there are others, and I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know what really I could say about the sort of rather gloomy Loveless film, except maybe that if I had my tongue in cheek, I'd be suggesting that an estranged couple struggling over what to do about a lost child. Well, I guess that could be Ukraine and Russia and the Donbass, but no. more seriously, I was looking at kind of the big budget, big picture, big audience mm-hmm. films or whatever. And it's interesting because, I mean, there's been recently there was Attraction, Fyodor Bondarchuk, science fiction sort mm-hmm. of film about, you know, an alien crash landing on Earth. There was Guardians, which is a very much a sort of comic book, Fantastic Four or whatever mm-hmm. Type thing, but sort of Soviet era. Not one, but two cosmonaut on Salyut 7 and Age of Pioneers, which is about Alexei Leonov, the first cosmonaut to do a spacewalk. Last Warrior, which is actually a Walt Disney-based thing, about a sort of modern kid who ends up in the land of legends. Furious, which actually is a very bad translation. It's basically Legend of Kolovrat in the Russian, which is about sumptuously filmed, actually. Plucky band of Russians fighting the Mongols when they first invaded
You've
Russia.
You've clearly been watching more Russian cinema than I have.
And the last one, which I must confess I have not seen because it involves sport, Going Vertical, which is about the plucky 1972 basketball victory over the Americans mm-hmm. in the Munich Olympics. And it's interesting because a lot of these...
Plucky is a charitable way of putting it.
Well, I mean, but that's how it's framed. but no, it's interesting because in many ways, if you look at these, on the surface, they all have a strong nationalist dimension. They are talking about precisely sort of Russian heroes, whether they're facing external challenges or internal challenges. But, you know, it could be the cosmonauts saying, hey, remember, we were up there in space. It could be fighting off the massive, huge sort of serried ranks of the Mongols or whatever. You know, all of these say that. So on one level, one can see how they fit into a certain narrative about Russia is getting up off its knees again. Russia is remembering what it means to be Russian. But I think the other interesting thing is there's still room for subversion. I mean, in Attraction, for example, in many ways, it's a parable for the race riots at Biryulyeva in Moscow that took place. You know, it's actually about, although it's got all the panoply of Tom Clancy-esque sort of techno-thriller military stuff, we've got, you know, Kamov helicopter gunships and guys with Kalashnikovs. When it comes down to it, it's actually a mob of Muscovites who are incited to attack the aliens, even though, because they think the aliens are evil and invading, even though it's just a crash landing. So there's an interesting kind of subversiveness that actually sort of says, well, no, this is not the way it ought to be. Actually, this is a way in which we can look at, frankly, a rather shady element of our recent past and actually appreciate actually why the mob is not right. The ordinary Russians, yes, I mean, obviously they're the sort of, you know, the heroes who actually save the day, but as it were, the ordinary Russians in the streets are often seen precisely as these sort of roving mobs. And elsewhere, often actually we see that there's sort of one of the lessons that comes out from these films is, as it were, that the formal structures of authority are not necessarily always the ones on which you must rely. You know, in Attraction, there's all the scenes of military commanders in their headquarters who don't really know what to do. In Legend of Kolovrat, again, there are the princes, but it's not the princes who actually will be out there saving Russians. It's going to be ordinary Russians. So I think what's interesting, I don't want to create some sort of grand super narrative to suggest that this is part of some kind of countercultural campaign by filmmakers to subvert the Kremlin. I think it's more that what it does say is, I think, even at the level of very pop culture, on the one hand, there is a need to fit within an apparent mainstream that basically says Russians, by God, Russians are a race of heroes, which is, of course, so totally unlike American mainstream filmmaking. But at the same time, I think time and time again, what bubbles forth from within the narrative is actually this awareness that it is not necessarily your formal leaders who have the answers and who actually are going to solve your problems, or who even necessarily care.
Now, I mean, this is something you saw in Soviet mainstream film as well, the fitting in, the subversion between the lines. I mean, think of, you know, the film that's shown every New Year's Eve at Onia Sudbi, Slukom Potom. You know, the idea that, you know, every apartment is exactly the same everywhere in Russia, whether you're in Moscow or Leningrad, and you can get confused about which city you're in. I thought that film was deeply subversive. For that reason. But so that's not really anything new. Anna, do you have any...
Well, can I just say one thing? You say not really new. I do not think we saw this in the 1990s. I think this is interesting. In so many bad ways, we have seen a restoration of a lot of Soviet instincts, the defensiveness, the self-censorship, and so forth. This is in some ways one of the heartening recoveries of Soviet-era practice, the subversiveness.
I think in Attraction, I was watching it, I was frankly quite confused. How is it that, you know, this is a film that's clearly making or attempting to make some sort of statement about xenophobia, and that it's obviously bad, and it did have parallels with Birilova. I mean, this is a film that's subverting and exposing some pretty serious issues. I'm not going to say they're not holy cows quite yet, but they are serious questions that Russian society and the Putin era is grappling with. I agree. I don't think we were really seeing this in the past. I think that "С легким паром," where, you know, they're kind of poking fun at the sameness
of everything.
Yeah, but it's the sameness, but this is done in very metaphorical terms still.
I don't think it was that metaphorical. I mean, the guy gets drunk, gets on a flight to Leningrad by accident, and like goes to the exact address. Everything is, his key works in his apartment. The furniture is the same. He goes in somebody else's apartment.
Yeah, but it's not really
subtle.
It's not subtle, but it's not a divisive issue. I think everybody agreed that this is life. This is our life. That's fine. I mean, whereas something like race riots, in Russia, it is a very divisive issue. Mm-hmm. I would say that the authorities in this regard are much more willing to crack down on xenophobia than your average, you know, guy from Birilova, who's going to say this is the reason these race riots are happening is because of corruption that's linked to ethnic diasporas, and this is a problem. And, you know, again, it's like it's divisive, and that these issues are being poked and exposed in films, I think that's a great thing, really.
But yet, you can go too far, apparently. The death of Stalin went too far.
Well, that's because this is done by foreigners.
This is what I wanted to get at. Is it because I was thinking about the contrast with Matilda.
Yeah.
And Matilda's a Russian film.
Actually,
right?
Yes. That's
and
a very
death
good
point. And
Death
of Stalin is a foreign film. And so I think that element, I think, is that can't be underestimated.
Exactly. You don't get to poke fun at our, like, we can, like, this is our thing. Like, okay, again, you're right. I think this is one of the reasons why it was much easier to stomach what Matilda was, because at least there's an understanding of our sacred cow. Like, we understand it, but you, who do not understand it, have no right to poke fun at it. I mean, I've encountered this sentiment a lot, actually.
Although, Mark, you think Iannucci pretty much got it right.
Well, that's what could be the worst thing.
But it's not a foreigner gets it right.
But hey, we've talked
so the worst
about...
sin you could do is attack our sacred cow and get it right. Yeah, have the nerve to get it right.
Precisely. I mean, I love the fact that sort of you almost have them trying to say, on the one hand, it's dangerous, and on the other hand, oh, it's a terrible film, it's so boring. And I'm thinking, well, if it's really that boring, you don't have to worry. But it was interesting because we talked in other contexts about how the Putin regime is much, much tougher on traitors than critics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between, you know, you don't like what we say and you actually were once one of us. Well, likewise, I think in this context, it's actually flipped around.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sense of if you're Russian and you have something to say, I mean, one can look at Leviathan, for example, right. You know, for absolutely sort of searing indictment of corruption mm-hmm. in the regions and so forth. But that was okay. If that had been done by a Western filmmaker, though, it would have been part of Gibridnaya Voyna. It would have been part of some information mm-hmm. warfare campaign against Russia.
All right. Anything to add before we move on to less lively topics? Well, not maybe not. Let's see. Sacred cows. Anything? Any other sacred cows that are untouchable?
Let's deal with Stalin first, and then we'll, you know, one by one we'll take down the others. I mean, Stalin's a pretty big deal that I think society really needs space and time to grapple with.
Because you have to wonder, like, and actually I was doing a thought experiment about this. I mean, the Yeltsin era is certainly an era that would be ripe for satire, right? Imagine a satire about the last days of the Yeltsin presidency. Think of the things that somebody like an Iannucci, for example, could do with that. Right? Now, would that touch a nerve? Because is Yeltsin's power also sacred? I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. It's a rhetorical question, but...
I mean, I think it would for two reasons. One is because obviously Yeltsin chose Putin.
Right. Yeah.
So there is that kind of, you know, tarnishing. But secondly, it's not necessarily going to be about Yeltsin so much as about state power and the Kremlin. Mm. Now, okay, one could try and
state
sort of stitch
power,
it around.
Which was tottering and weak and divided and balkanized.
Now, I suppose maybe, though, again, you know, if they really want to go and hire Armando Iannucci to do this, and please, if, you know... If VVP is listening, let me encourage that. Is actually what you could do. I mean, again, I'm sure with the classic thing would be almost to frame Putin precisely as the one who comes and fixes it.
Yeah,
but then it would look
exactly like what it is.
Well, absolutely. But no. But the point is, that's the only way I think it could be made acceptable to the Kremlin is precisely to draw an artificially sharp line and sort of say all the bad stuff was before. You know, and then post-Putin, things are different.
Perfect, except, I mean, if I were to see the film I'd like to see about that period, that is precisely not what it would do.
Quite.
On that note, we'll shift gears in a few moments. We will continue our discussion and look at a list that was very much on the minds of the Russian elite. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Also within the studio is Anna Aratunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group and author of the book, The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Вы видели этот список? Это просто алфавитный перечень российского списка форм.
То есть, по сути, всех нас, всех 146 миллионов...
Значение этого списка – zero. Оно стремится к нулю.
Но это, безусловно, недружественный акт. Он осложняет...
It's been called an unprecedented and unfriendly act, as well as an act of economic warfare. But it's also been derided as nothing more than a who's who in Russian politics, as well as a cut-and-paste job from the Kremlin website in the Forbes list of the wealthiest Russians. It, of course, is the U.S. Treasury Department's much-anticipated list of the most influential Russian officials and oligarchs who could be subject to future sanctions, which was released this week. Mark, your thoughts on the list and on the mixed Russian reaction to it, because it was indeed mixed.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this breaks my heart because, you know, I've long been an advocate precisely for personal rather than sectoral sanctions. Mm-hmm. And then this list comes out that, okay, we don't know precisely the process behind it. There are suggestions that it was a sort of a last-minute replacement. Because certainly this list is, in my opinion...
there seems to have been some wrangling inside the US.
This is an almost laughable sort of list as is, just simply to basically just, you know, pick all the people who are sort of top level, you know, who are ministers, people in the presidential administration, and everyone who's got $1 billion or more.
Well, yeah, the oligarch part of it is basically they cut off the Forbes list at $1 billion is what it looks like. And as a result, a lot of people, like the CEO of Yandex, like the man who makes Stolichnaya vodka and doesn't even live in Russia, are on the list. And some people who are obviously close to the Kremlin, like Chubais, are not on the list. So I think that there's that. But well, go ahead.
I think there is a classified annex, we know. So, I mean, you know, hopefully that is more useful. I think the problem is that, you know, so much attention had been sort of directed towards the fact that this list was coming out. I never bought the idea that there was the same panic in Moscow as some people were saying. But nonetheless, I mean, it is clear that there are...
Although there was clearly concern.
From certain quarters, but again, unfortunately, the people who you might say have most reason to be worried are, on the whole, the people who are most engaged with the West, who are, on the whole, not actually the most Putinophilic ones. Mm-hmm. I think the trouble is by presenting it like this, and yes, this is just a start point, and this is not in itself sanctioned, so it makes these people all politically exposed, in other words, for due diligence and such like. But by its very lack of differentiation and lack of sophistication and lack of subtlety, it more or less says... it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter if you secretly bankroll critics. It doesn't matter if you are clearly not interested in supporting the Kremlin, or indeed if you are a full-throated booster of even the last thing that Putin says. We will treat you as if you are the same. One of the great values of this, and let's be honest, this is economic warfare, and hurrah for that. And it is information warfare, and hurrah for that. But the point is that, you know, one of the key virtues would have been precisely to drive wedges. And by making it in a situation that all kinds of people who are much, much more significant as sort of Putin allies and cronies and agents are not on the list and others aren't, it makes at best the Americans look as if they've wasted an opportunity. At worst, that the Americans are clueless.
Mm. Now, I tend to look at this as one kind of point in a process. And the process, despite the obvious flaws that you've pointed out here, the process is that the era when you can make your money in a kleptocracy and stash it in the safe harbors of the West, the era when you can seek to overthrow the rules-based international order while at the same time using that same rules-based international order to protect your ill-gotten wealth, that's over. Access to the West safe harbors now at least requires a nod to the West rules, right? I mean, we're not there yet, but this is yet another data point along that line that this era is coming to an end. And I'm going to offer a counterpoint. I made the same point on the Daily Vertical earlier this week about that it doesn't the lack of differentiation in the list, I think, inadvertently might have a positive effect. Might, I would add. And this is that anybody who benefits from this regime, whether or not they're an active supporter of it, whether or not they're a Putin crony, but if you are benefiting from this in one way or another, then you're complicit and you're liable. And I think that is a powerful message. And finally, you touched on this, Mark, the fact that everybody on this list now, and even somebody due to the classified annex that are not, are going to be wondering, can I get a visa? Can I open a Western bank account? Western banks are going to be thinking twice before they deal with anybody on this list. So I think even despite all the clear flaws that you pointed out, I think this is not a total disaster. Anna, what are your thoughts on this? This is the big story of the week.
I'm afraid I have few good things to say about the outcome of this list, because I think that, I mean, I agree with Mark, if you're going to have targeted precision sanctions, they've got to be sanctions, but you've got to clearly understand what is being punished here. With this kind of undifferentiated list, perception matters. The way it's going to be perceived in Russia matters, and that hasn't really been taken into account. And the main issue here is that what this can do is play very well into the Kremlin narrative of Russophobia. When you have, I'm not saying that sanctions are wrong. I'm saying that sanctions need to be clear.
These aren't sanctions.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. They're not even sanctions. So yes, they make it difficult. They expose these figures. With what objective exactly, other than creating a climate of fear for them, that anybody who in any way was affiliated with Putin, is now like it, I think it sows more confusion than actually creates objective countermeasures that can indicate to Russia where it needs to change its behavior.
Yeah, although again, I would point out this was mandated by a law that was passed by Congress. It was simply one step in the process. This is not the sanctions. This is the public portion of a list of the most influential Russians. We don't know, at least I don't know. I don't have security clearance. What's in the classified annex to this? We don't know what's coming next.
Well, then perhaps clarify what exactly. I mean, I would suggest this to the U.S. Department of State, for instance. Clarify exactly.
Or the Treasury in this case.
Well, or the Treasury, right? But I think this would be a diplomatic issue. Mm-hmm. Clarify what exactly are we saying here with this list?
And again, it appears, if you can believe the press reports, that there was some internal wrangling in the administration and between the administration and Congress over this. And it's not entirely clear what happened here. If there was a different list that was then replaced by essentially a cut-and-paste job of the Forbes list and the Kremlin website, we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And until, if and when the classified annex is ever made public, we probably won't know. Although I would assume you're going to start getting some leaks about what actually happened here.
True, but I mean, you've done a valiant job of trying to put a positive spin on this. I'm not sure if not a total disaster.
A less negative spin on it.
Yes, okay, but so not a total disaster. But I think the thing is, look, first of all, the classified element, because it's classified, will have, in and of itself, almost no impact, except maybe for applying for US visas.
Mm.
You know, banks are not going to know about it. Other companies, potential sort of people who might be business partners or whatever, will not know about it. So if you're going to name and shame, then actually naming people very quietly in a dark room where no one else can hear is probably not very helpful. More generally, again, I think the trouble is, let's say that you are someone on that list. You know, you are on the Forbes list and your number, whoever that may be, you know, sort of 92. And you're thinking, okay, I don't want to be on that list. Well, in a way, this is not the sanctions, this is only a first stage. But nonetheless, this is all we've got for the moment. What are you going to do? Say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give up $100 million. So that I fall below the threshold? No, of course not. There is no... I mean, you can... This only works if there is some kind of meaningful decision tree. Oh, well, I don't want to be this, so what can I do? And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by making it so broad and so, frankly, crass... And so you've got the head of the Federal Archives, for heaven's sake... which to the best of my knowledge, try as I might, I do not regard that role as being a crucial one in the power structure. But the point is that the people on this list, I mean, and unless you're expecting them to suddenly take up their pitchforks and storm the Kremlin, which is not going to happen, unfortunately.
I don't think that was the goal.
Exactly, no, but what is the goal? Because you say, complicit, watch out. But the point is, you have no scope.
No, I'm saying that could
be
the effect. I think what we saw here was the result of a lack of consensus inside the U.S. elite about what to do here. And I think that there was my hypothesis is that, yeah, Congress mandated this. The president signed this law over, reluctantly, to say the least. But there was enough votes to override a veto. So this is what you got. You probably don't have consensus within the administration. You certainly don't have it between the administration and Congress. So you get this.
No, I'm sure you're right, because it certainly has never been my impression that people in Treasury and OFAC in particular are imbeciles.
No, absolutely.
There's actually
the opposite.
A huge and detailed and sensitive awareness of the complex networks of money, complicity and power.
No, the people that deal with Russia in Treasury have a stellar reputation. actually.
Exactly. And that is why, I think you're absolutely right about the process that led to this list. My own view is, and I appreciate that there's all kind of political constraints and it's easy for me to say, but to be perfectly honest, better not to have had a list out, or to have a list that is just so short as to be obviously just a kind of a holding action. Mm. But this is what we wait to see, is exactly what's going to happen. Because this is the other bit about turning to Anna's point about how it plays at the moment. Exactly, actually, it has allowed Putin to basically win at home, because it says, oh well, it's just crass Russophobia. It's also just stupid Russophobia, and also it's, look, if you're on this list and you face a threat, then basically your best option is to be in well with the Kremlin. The Kremlin will look after people who are good boys and girls, because there's no option out. Now, okay, so it's a question of what happens next. If we then see something much more sharp and purposeful emerging, then this list gets forgotten. That it's old news. If it doesn't happen, and this is my concern, that precisely about what you're talking about, a lack of consensus in Washington, if we don't actually start seeing something happen, it makes America look toothless. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is dangerous.
Anna, last thoughts before we wrap it up? Anything to...
Yeah, I mean, I think the clear thing here is, the important thing here is, what options do these targeted individuals have? If you're not giving them an option of correcting their behavior, and you're not making it clear what exactly they're expected to do, really, their only option is to rally around the Kremlin, and I think that is that's the kind of detrimental effect of issuing sanctions that aren't really thought through.
Well, we're not to sanctions yet, remember?
Right, I know. I mean the whole process of blacklists, targets.
This isn't even a blacklist. This was simply legislation required that the administration produce a list of the most influential Russian figures.
But in context, precisely by making people considered to be politically exposed, it does have an impact. It is. I mean, even if we want to say, okay, it's merely a dark grey list. But nonetheless, it is not just simply here's a list of people just saying.
Right. But it is supposed to be, again, just the most politically connected, influential figures in Russia. Now, you know, if you're going to do that, it's not surprising that it would come from the Forbes list and the Kremlin website.
But
right?
what are these people going to do? Are they going to come out and say we need to give Crimea back to Ukraine? What is it that they're supposed to be doing exactly? Giving up their money or leaving Russia or what?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think this is about what they're supposed to be doing. I think this is more about, it's a stage in a process of potential personal sanctions from the U.S. side for those who are affiliated with, you know, or complicit in the actions of the regime. I don't think it's like saying, all right, you're on this list, now you have to do X, Y, and Z, and that'll get you off it. It's not like being placed on probation.
True, okay, but if they're complicit, how exactly can they not be complicit?
Again, I don't know, and I'm not sure it's about that.
Let me put it another way. Given that, I mean, putting aside the question of the fact of Congress said there needs to be something and therefore something has to appear. Okay. But otherwise, what is the point of this list? I mean, if it's just simply a box-ticking exercise, then okay, well and good. But on the other hand, it's not, for example, this in any way constrains future sanctions. It's not like saying if you're not on this list, you can't be sanctioned later. Nor does it say if you are on this list, you will be sanctioned later. Then what good does it do? Other than just ticks that box.
As they say in Russia, это вопрос не ко мне. That's a question for the United States Congress and the United States Treasury, neither of which I
didn't mean it for you. I just think it's a good question to raise. Obviously not to you, but just, I mean, to be thought about. And as you said, this is a process. And, where is this process going and what is it trying to achieve?
I mean, I think, you know, all of the hype that took place before this kind of created an atmosphere where inevitably, no matter what they came out with, there was going to be disappointment, or relief, for that matter. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. And also with us in the studio has been Anna Arutunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group and author of the book, The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an interesting and enlightening discussion.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.